what did you have for breakfast today?
For breakfast today, I had one espresso coffee.
That's it?
And an apple.
An apple. Well, at least you're doing something healthy.
And a piccolo.
A piccolo.
Yes.
On top of an espresso.
On top of an espresso. Normally have the piccolo first, but I thought I'd sort of, you know, change it around today.
How many coffees do you have a day?
I've cut back. I would probably be having about half a dozen, but there was a point in my life I was drinking at least 12 a day.
Wow. Yeah, if I did that, I'd be in hospital.
It's really interesting. Everyone has a different effect from caffeine. I can have an espresso before I go to bed and I sleep like a baby.
Welcome to the Uncommon Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Michaelides. The goal of the Uncommon Podcast is to build your worldly wisdom. And this worldly wisdom was coined by Charlie Munger, who is Warren Buffett's business partner. For me, it's about becoming a better investor, a business operator, and a well-rounded individual. Now, we do this by interviewing unique guests, investigating interesting topics, helping you to build this uncommon sense, as Charlie coined it back in the day. Our guests are wide. Some of those have included venture capitalists, strength coaches, bodybuilders, political activists, startup founders, business executives, chefs, restaurateurs, and rappers, to just name a few. Our style, you'll notice, is very much inspired by the likes of Joe Rogan, Charlie Rose, Oprah Winfrey, and Tim Ferriss. So it's sort of that investigative one-on-one style that we like to uncover with the guest. If you want to learn more about previous guests before we get into this episode, please just head over to www.neurall.com/podcast. If you enjoyed the episode, maybe consider leaving us a review, and you can do that by heading to either iTunes or Stitcher on the web. Search Uncommon Neural and it'll be the first podcast to come up. You can leave a simple review there. We'd really appreciate that. You should also consider signing up to our newsletter. I think 90% of our subscribed listeners are subscribed to the newsletter as well. That just means that you get priority access and show notes first up. You can do that just by heading to www.neural.com/podcast. And also, don't forget to like us on Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, or Instagram. It's just at Neural on all of those platforms. We push out a lot of spliced content and cool little sneak peeks for the episode that's coming up, so also consider that as well. Hope you enjoy. In this week's episode, we recorded with Paul DiMartino. His family has been a part of the coffee industry for well over 50 years, I think. Now, that started with the founding of Mokopan by Paul's uncles and father, which I think paved the way for many well-known brands in the industry, including Coffex, Crevalli, Grinders, and Genovese. The heritage of Mokopan, I think the necessity to fend for his family, led Paul to start DiMartino Coffee in 1998. Obviously, as a family friend, it's been one of my favorite coffee brands over the years. You'll notice that in this episode, Paul has a strong emphasis on family, heritage, and the importance of the simpler things in life. This episode was very much a personal one for myself. I've known Paul for my entire life, with him being a close family friend. He's the godfather to my sister. I think that he can make just about anyone laugh. And for that very reason, he personifies the fact that hospitality can bring people closer together. And also, his knowledge of the industry is quite unique, and you'll get that through the episode as we touch on things like family history, how his family got into coffee, how hospitality can be such a rewarding lifestyle, the impact of Mokopan, and why he started DiMartino Coffee. And then we focus on, in particular, how he described the industry now. DiMartino is a huge brand. It's in Asia. It's across Australia. And I think starting to jump into China in particular as well now. So I think for anyone who enjoys coffee and understanding the industry, this would be a really enjoyable episode. If you enjoyed this one, maybe check out two other episodes around hospitality, food and wine. Angie G, episode 3, where we covered hospitality in particular, and then Geordie K, which was episode 19, creating good stories with wine. If you want to check out the show notes for those, you can just head to naral.com/podcast. So as I said, bit of a personal episode for myself. I had a lot of fun. It's a bit of a shorter one, but I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. So without any further ado or ceremony, please enjoy this conversation with Paul Dimitena. We're live. Paul, thanks for joining.
Pleasure, Jordan. Nice to be here.
I want to start with everyone. We start with their childhood. What's your earliest memory from your childhood?
My earliest memory? Well, there's two earliest memories. From a hospitality point of view, I was 3 years of age, and I remember going to Pellegrini's Espresso Bar in Bourke Street, Melbourne. My father was a director of a coffee company at that point in time, and for a period there, we were supplying coffee. And I remember on a Saturday morning, I was 3, he picked me up and put me on a bar stool. And I was in that particular venue with about maybe 60, 70 men. It was like a men-only venue at that point in time in Melbourne. And everybody was smoking, and it was like sitting in a steam room. But that was my first introduction to hospitality. My second earliest childhood memory was being almost abducted out the front of my family home.
Really?
On a Sunday afternoon, Mum said, you can go sit out the front. We're going visiting to my auntie's place. And a car pulled up, and a man opened up the passenger door, and he said, come in, have some lollies. And he had a big, I'll never forget it, a big tin of Quality Street chocolates. And he lifted it up, and he said, come on in, you're him. Come and have a lolly or a chocolate. And I was just as I was hopping in the car, I was about 3 and a half. Mum came out and screamed her head off, and he just pushed me as hard as he could in the chest. I went flying out the door, landed on the nature strip, and he sped off. And Mum and Dad rang the police, but they never caught the offender. But just goes to show you, fate was on my side. I was meant to be here for a bit longer.
Yeah, wow. Where did you live? Where did you grow up?
East Bentley.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Had your dad always been involved in coffee?
No, he hasn't. Dad was actually a projectionist at the Metro Melbourne in Glenferrie Road, and he was a young projectionist there and showing movies in those days, and that was huge in the theatre at that point in time. I mean, going to the theatre, you had to book 3 weeks in advance to get in. Everyone was wearing, it was black tie virtually on a Saturday night, and hors d'oeuvres and champagne and interval, and it was a big thing to go to the movie theatre.
Wow.
They all had magnificent swooping staircases like something out of Gone with the Wind. And it was big business. There was a lot of celebrities that were managing the theatres, musical theatre people. My mother was the booking clerk. And Mum said people used to book 2, 3, 4 weeks in advance to get a movie ticket on a Saturday night. That's how big a deal it was. And Dad was showing the movies. And that's how they met.
Really?
They met there at the Metro Melbourne in Glenferrie Road.
So tell us about your dad, because this will be a key theme in our interview.
Yeah, my father was one of 7, born to an Italian immigrant, Domenico Di Martino, who arrived in Australia on August the 8th, 1914, as a 16-year-old. He was the first Di Martino to arrive in Australia. Dad was one of 7, 4 sisters, and there were 3 boys, so he had 2 brothers. Like most men of that period in time, they left school at an early age. He was working in the wholesale fruit and vegetable market for a period with his father, who was a partner in a business with his brother. And at that point in time, the Di Martinos were fairly leading wholesale fruit merchants in the market. In 1954, my uncle Joe Di Martino, with the backing of his uncle, my late uncle Frank Di Martino, approached a food processing plant in Preston, and they wanted to buy the food processing plant and then engage in importing a roaster from Europe to start manufacturing coffee, because Joe Di Martino believed with the mass input of post-war Europeans coming into the country that there was a huge market for espresso coffee. Something that was fairly much unheard of at that point in time. So it was a bit of a gamble, but Uncle Frank and his colleagues back Joe, and they brought in the roaster and they started roasting coffee, and they were moving some other small food goods and so forth, but that stopped after a while. But there were three owners of the food processing factory. That was Monici, Panettiere, and Coppertini. So hence Joe decided to use a little bit of each one's name and created the name Mokkapan. And wow. Mok was obviously affiliated with coffee, but it was actually those three guys. So Monici stayed on with Joe for a period and was the director of Mokkapan in the very first couple of years. Then he parted ways with Joe, and then in 1956, my father left his profession as a projectionist and joined his brother Joe at Mokkapan Coffee and became a shareholder in the business, and primarily was involved in sales. So Joe was the managing director, and Dad was the sales director. And then another cousin, Dominic DiMartina, joined in 1958, and he was the production manager. So those three young men then predominantly became the soundboard and the foundation of building the whole coffee industry for Mokkapan. Well, not for the industry, but for Mokkapan. And they became leaders in the industry. They really did, because they were very innovative. Particularly Joe was very innovative with his packaging, his marketing, his branding, doing a lot of trade shows. And some of the things that Joe was doing in the 50s and early 60s still holds its own today. Innovative packaging and tins and so forth. Some of those early trade shows, our stands were award-winning stands. They were fantastic. Some really good marketing and branding. So, and Dad was involved there. He was involved in selling coffee from 1956 to 1969. He was a sales director for 13 years in the coffee industry. So as a young child, myself and my cousins, we grew up in the factory, climbing on coffee sacks and, you know, running around on the back of forklifts and kicking the footy in the factory and playing cricket in the driveway of the factory. And of course, Mokkapan was always having these fabulous family functions and Christmas parties, and we were playing with all the other children of the employees, and the employees were like family, extended family. It was a wonderful, wonderful business, and that business continued to grow for a long period of time. Then in 1969, Dad resigned his position as a sales director of Mokkapan, and he bought a coffee lounge restaurant in Church Street, Brighton. And Dad sold his shares to his cousin Frank DiMartina, who was the playing for the Richmond Footy Club in those days and for North Melbourne, and Frank was a superstar and still a superstar of our family. Frank came in and took on the role of sales director for, I think, for about 3 or 4 years. Then Frank went back into the restaurant industry. But nonetheless, as a DiMartino, I grew up in that industry. So we've always been involved in hospitality, from the as providors in the fruit and vegetable market to starting to roast coffee and create Mokkapan as an entity. And, of course, along the way, there's just been dozens and dozens and dozens of cafes and restaurants that various family members have owned, my father including. He had the coffee planter in Church Street for about 8 or 9 years. So a lot of my childhood was spent in Church Street, Brighton, at the coffee planter growing up. Then Dad sold the coffee planter in 1978 and then embarked on a holiday with Mum, hadn't had one for a long time, and very sadly passed away on his second or third day into the holiday.
Really?
So he had a massive heart attack and passed away. So, but that was my introduction into the coffee industry. When I left school, I had a heap of jobs as well. Then in 1982-83, I got lured into the coffee industry. I loved hospitality, but the moment I set foot into it, it was for me. You know, when you just find something, you know, it just rocks your boat. That was it.
What was it about it? What was that feeling that you had?
I think the greatest thing about the industry was that it was still young. No 2 days were ever the same. So everything was still new. And I'm going back even in the early 80s, because you think about where the industry is today, compared to what it was in the early 80s. Now, you're probably too young to remember, but it's just been this wonderful ride, this wonderful change, a lot of innovation. It's just been a really exciting period and time to be involved in the industry. And I'm talking hospitality in general. The coffee industry has been a real leader in change and innovation in that time. And no 2 days were ever the same. You go to work and every day you would meet someone new, someone exciting. you'd meet an entrepreneur, you'd meet someone who was flamboyant, you'd meet someone who was hysterically funny, you'd meet someone who was mad as as anything. So you'd always meet these intriguing people. And then, of course, you're walking in and out of cafes, restaurants, bars, clubs, pubs that, you know, are just fantastic because they're new, they're innovative, it's a brand new fit out, it's a brand new menu, and you were seeing things you'd never seen before. So it was just this wonderful learning curve because, in another job I wouldn't know about all these things, but I was seeing them firsthand. The other thing is that I knew Melbourne like the back of my hand. By the time I was 21, I could drive into every suburb. No Melways for me to get out in those days. I just knew exactly where I was going. So because, my job took me all over Melbourne.
Yeah.
Where a lot of other of my friends and peers would have the one job in the one area,
yeah,
and they just socialised in that one little bubble.
Yeah.
Where when I was 21, 22, I was saying, hey, let's go out for dinner in North Carlton. And I had friends in East Bentley going, where's North Carlton? and you need to realise back then it was fairly territorial. People hung in their little suburbs and didn't really venture out that much.
Yeah. I don't think a lot of our listeners would get that, but you're definitely right. It was a different world back then. No Google Maps, that's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, going to Smith Street, Collingwood in 1984, most of my friends never did that. Going out to Brunswick or Coburg, they just didn't do that. I remember saying to one person once I'd been out to Maribyrnong, and this is going back when I was about 21, 22, where's Maribyrnong? Is that in regional Victoria? Things like that. So my job gave me this greater, broader understanding of Melbourne and its cultures and what it had to offer. So I've always been a huge fan of Melbourne. I love Melbourne as much as anything. And every day, even now at my age, when I come into the CBD or I drive to work, I'm driving around, I just marvel at just what a great city Melbourne is and has become. It is one of the great cities of the world.
When you drive in now from the airport, you just, I don't know, I just feel proud. Like, because to see the city as it is now and how big it is.
Oh, absolutely. We're a market leader.
Yeah.
I travel, on an international level now with work quite a lot, and of course I'm all over Australia with work. Melbourne is a world leader.
Mm.
It is a world leader. In restaurants, cafes, wines, coffee, all things hospitality. And then, of course, we haven't even touched on sport and arts and culture and everything else. But today's conversation is about hospitality and coffee, and we are a world leader, we're a market leader, we're innovative. People around the world talk about Melbourne as a great city.
How do you think, or what impact do you think Mokopan had on the industry?
I think it had a significant impact, there's no doubt. I mean, it wasn't just Mokopan, there was other coffee companies.
Yeah.
But
like, I say this because when I was reading through some of the stuff about Dimitina Coffee, you had this interview with Coffee Bean Scene, I think it is.
Bean Scene,
that's it. And they spoke about just like the brands that came from the wider family.
But it's interesting, Jordan, because that probably is significant to most industries.
Yeah.
People have got to do their apprenticeship somewhere and learn their craft somewhere. But it's interesting. I mean, Dominic Crivelli, who started Coffex, and they were a huge company.
Yeah.
He started with Mokopan and worked with my father. Giancarlo Gusti, and I know these guys very, very well. They're great pioneers and innovators in the industry. Giancarlo Gusti, he started with Mokopan. He started Grinders Coffee. And he took that company to a level that was quite amazing, really. I would say in the mid-1990s, Grinders was the most respected boutique coffee company in Victoria, without doubt.
Wow.
So obviously today it's institutionalised and been bought by Coca-Cola and still doing huge numbers, but it's just its client base is a different client base to what it was then. But there's a lot of people. Paul Burrell, though, great guy, great fella, great innovative person in the industry. He started with Mokopan as well. So, but there was a lot. There's probably been about six or seven over the journey that have gone and started coffee companies or worked for other coffee companies.
Yeah, but I think you're right, though, by saying that with any industry as it starts to grow, that there's sort of there's a group of people that's started out and then they expand from there. I had some... You're definitely a guy of one-liners. I mean, I've always known that since I've been growing up. But when I spoke to your two boys, and I want to preface this with the question, do you have core principles in life? But some of these quotes that we've heard, crying baby always gets fed first, squeaky wheel gets the oil. I've never heard you say that one.
Well, what does that means is someone who keeps basically whinging and whinging and moaning and groaning, and they normally get what they want in the end. A squeaky wheel gets oiled, you know. So
there's another one there. It's not what you earn, it's what you spend. Is that one?
Yeah, that's a cliche from my father. And I suppose that it's got a bit of significance. It's not, you know, it's not all about what you earn, it's what you spend. So you can be, you know, the greatest earner of all time, but if you're earning $200,000 a year but you're spending $250,000, you're going backwards.
Yeah.
If you're earning $60,000 a year and you're spending $40,000, you're actually doing better than the person that's earning $250,000. But that's subjective to what you think. But you got to that's subjective to what you think constitute what's better. I mean, how do you view what's better? But you got to understand, these are cliches coming from people in the 1970s and 60s who, you know, were very hard-working people and had different values to what we have today. They wouldn't travel overseas and spend money on an overseas trip or go out for dinner.
No.
But, so,
well, do you have any core principles in life that you sort of always abide by?
Yeah, I do. I think I can honestly say in my 34 years – or 36 years maybe now, I'm getting old, 38 years in the workforce, 38 years in the workforce, but particularly in my, say, 30-odd years in business and so forth, I've never once ever done the wrong thing in terms of business values.
Yeah.
So if I was to shut shop tomorrow night, I could put my head in a pillow and sleep very comfortably knowing I've paid every single due that I've had to pay along the journey. I've never set anyone up. I've never
You're not a snake.
No, I don't think I have. I think I'm a very honest person in business.
Yeah.
Probably don't explain myself as well as I should at times. But no, I'm a person that believes you've got to get the balance right, because I love social time. I love playtime. And I think that's really important. I think you need hobbies in life. I think a lot of people that just go family work, family work, family work.
Yeah.
That's great. That's wonderful. I like to think there's family work and something else. And that might be a game of squash. It might be going to the gym for an hour. It might be playing football. It might be doing whatever. But having a hobby outside of those two, I think, is really important for an individual, particularly in terms of their personal development. I think that's really, really important.
Yeah.
But
I've had to learn that the hard way. You definitely need something to get your mind out of just doing work.
Yeah, yeah, going for a run was the greatest thing I could ever do. I remember, you know, doing a couple of laps of the tan or something. It was like somebody lifted the whole weight of the world off my shoulders. So it was just fabulous.
Yeah.
You know, really, really good.
I think, would it be fair to say that football is your hobby?
Oh, footy's my hobby. There's no doubt. I love football. Yeah. Absolutely love it. I, as you know, I've spent most of my life heavily involved in footy, and people say, Paul Dimmer, how do you do it? Why do you do it? You haven't got time for it. Football's very therapeutic for me, even though people who played under me as a coach, and even now as president of the Bentley Football Netball Club, people would say, it doesn't look very relaxed. It's therapeutic for me. Getting away from the football scene and getting away from the every other mundane thing in your life, is meeting new people and meeting characters and people you would never meet in the work environment, or you would never meet in your own social environment. And that's the great thing about football clubs, well, not just footy clubs, sporting clubs and organisations. It harnesses a group of people that would never meet. So you're socialising and you're doing things with people that you just wouldn't cross paths in any other industry. So, and all of a sudden, if you're playing contact sport, where you've really got to rely on each other and you've got to take a hit for each other, it creates this amazing camaraderie. And all of a sudden you've got this camaraderie with someone who can potentially become a lifelong friend, who really, other than going to that particular club, you would never have met, and then they've become such a fantastic part of your life. So,
yeah.
And network's a huge thing. It helps in business. There's no doubt in the coffee industry, probably more than most other industries, network is huge, absolutely huge. And I've got a very large network. I'm very, very fortunate. I've got over 200 cousins and relatives, and I've been in the industry for a long, long time, so I know a lot of people, and sport's been very, very kind to me. I've met thousands of people in sport along the way, so that's a great thing.
Yeah, including my dad.
Including your dad.
Now, before
he could never beat me in a run. Never.
Really?
Never beat me in a run. No, he'd always be about 30 seconds behind me, looking at his watch while he was running around the team.
So is that then why he's always bringing up this time that you guys were down at, you're playing a game at Port Melbourne?
Yep.
He's always bringing about the story of the time you got knocked out at Port Melbourne. Maybe that's why, because he can't beat you in a run.
That's right. I got knocked out a lot of times, though.
Now, before we get into talking about the coffee business and Dimitina Coffee, I have to bring up Aunty June because she's just a classic.
Cut the story short.
And the story I was given was apparently she used to call you at the office all the time demanding to speak to you.
That's right.
And there was this one time where, maybe it was multiple times, the receptionist would race in and you were in an important meeting. She'd say there's an emergency on, rah, rah, rah. And you'd run out. You'd answer the phone and she'd say, Paul, if you were taller and had hair, you could be good looking.
That is correct. Now, poor Aunty June, she's not with us anymore, but she never married or had a family, mother's twin sister. But Aunty June was, let's just say she wasn't quite your average person, but very eccentric. But I was her primary carer to a certain degree. And anyway, she would ring all the time and you couldn't get her off the phone.
Yeah.
And if you didn't answer your phone, she would ring repeatedly for maybe 30 times in a row. Then if you still didn't answer your phone, she'd ring the police. So,
really?
Or she'd ring the fire brigade. She was very quite erratic.
What did she teach you, though? Did it give you a bit of perspective, you know, when you're having to care for someone like
that? Yeah. Well, I think with Aunty June, I've got to say it's determination. Determination. She had a fantastic work ethic. Her principles of making money and work probably weren't the same as mine, but she certainly had a very strong work ethic.
Yeah.
And very determined. And she, you talk about the wheel that squeaks gets oiled. Well, she did a lot of squeaking.
Yeah.
So she sort of worked her way up from there, and she did quite well for herself. But she was very funny. I mean, at times she'd drive me nuts, but she was funny. I mean, she'd say some ridiculous things. It was so funny. She really would. She'd often say to me, you know, Paul, if you were just maybe 4 inches taller, about 10 kilo lighter and had hair, you'd actually be quite handsome. So thanks, Aunty June. But she defied the odds. I mean, she died at 91, and right up until 12 weeks before she died, she was still smoking 30 Peter Jackson 16 milligram cigarettes a day and eating fried dim sims and drinking VB long necks. And
is there any lessons then that you hold and learnt either directly or indirectly from your own parents?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. One of the great lessons is pride. Pride's a good thing, but pride can be very detrimental to you as well.
Right.
In business. So you've got to realise that there's times when you've made a mistake. There's times when you need to apologise. There's times when you make the wrong remark or you get it wrong or whatever. Business is about making a lot of mistakes.
Mm.
But it's about acknowledging those mistakes, learning from them, not getting hung up over it. You know, I've always said to people I work with, we all make mistakes. I'm going to make them, still do. The other thing with pride is that too many people get into a personal running race with someone over who's going to be the most successful or who's going to sell the most coffee or who's going to make the most money or who's going to do this and who's going to do that. And it can actually leave people very very unhappy, full of angst. So as much as pride can be a good thing, be proud of what you do and have pride in what you do. Don't let pride become a negative factor for you as well.
Yeah,
that's one thing. Obviously, strong work ethic. I've got to say, transparency.
Yeah,
honesty. I mean, I all my business dealings, you know, I've always looked at people in the eye, and if I can't do something, I tell them I can't do it. Mm. I don't take to people a lot in business that tell me they can do something, and then knowingly they can't do it, and they just tried to give the perception they can. I'd just rather people say to me, look, I can't do that. I'm sorry. And that's fine. I really respect it, you know.
Yeah.
So that's always been something that's important. I mean, the other thing is you've got to have fun. You've got to have fun at work. If you're going to spend, let's just say, 50 hours a week working, it needs to be fun. You need to be having a good time while you're doing it. We're not on the earth for a long time.
Yeah.
You know, my father used to say to me, we spend your 30 life working, 30 life sleeping, and your 30 life socialising.
Yeah.
So he said, you want to enjoy your work, have a good bed, and have good friends. And but it's true. We're not here for a long time.
Yeah.
And I can't believe how quickly my life's going by now. And it's actually starting to scare me. I want to put the handbrake on. But I've always had a lot of fun at work. I like to go to work and laugh.
Yeah.
I like to be around people that feel good. I like to be around people that crack jokes, smile, laugh. I think the world takes itself very, very seriously today. And I actually see so many people today who look unhappy in the workplace. There's a lot of angst. Now, I understand there's a lot of stress in the workplace today, and people are probably working longer hours than they've worked in previous generations, or certainly in regards to my generation. I think when I was in my 20s and 30s, we weren't working as long and as hard as what people today are in their 20s and 30s. And I think, you know, the world's a lot more competitive today. It seems to be a lot more competitive. But you really need to have fun.
Yeah.
You really need to have fun. You need to go to work and have fun. And I think if you're having fun, you enjoy it. If you enjoy it, you get good at it. If you get good at it, you become successful.
I think a lot of people, just chase money and power as opposed to just doing something that they can really get into.
Well, I think that word you said, power, is really interesting, isn't it?
Well, yeah. It's a natural – it's part of the human biology. It's something that we can't help. We all chase it in different ways. I think a lot of people, because there's a lot of, you know, you would understand this. I mean, we've just spoken about this before, like the things like social media and what it does to your frame of reference and how people externalize a lot now.
Yeah.
They're not keeping like an internal scorecard, if that makes sense. They're just worrying about what other people think.
Look, it's amazing. Growing up, my generation did not have to really deal with that in early parts of our career. It exists a little bit now, but I think when you start engaging social media at our age, it doesn't have the same impact on your life that it did for people in their 20s and 30s and teens. I actually feel sorry for the pressures that people feel from that. I mean, you know, it's like on a Sunday morning, everyone in the world's got to put a photo of what they're having for breakfast and tell people where they are. It's like it's a contest. I'm in a better cafe than you, and I'm having a more expensive breakfast than you, and I'm doing. I don't get that. I don't understand why we need to tell the world what we're doing in every single moment of our life. But you know, that's the way the world's
going. Yeah, it's a confusing thing to work through because it does have good components to it, but also it can become a bit much for some people.
Yeah, look, it's great for business. I mean, what I can just, you know, this morning I'm sending out an email to 30 people at once. I mean, in the old days, trying to get that message out to 30 people, you know, you'd have a letter typed up and you'd put it in their pigeonhole at work, and then someone would forget to get it, and you'd have to follow up with phone calls on landlines and all that sort of thing. So from a communication point of view, it's fantastic. And you would think with social media today, and this is the irony of it all, though, never before in the history of human beings in the Western world have we had so much power with technology. Never before have we had so many technical devices that save us time. Yet no one has got any time.
Yeah.
Ask someone to do something, I'm too busy. Yet everything in life today is about saving your time, yet no one's got any time.
Do you remember your kids watching a show called Around the Twist? Does that ring a bell?
Not really.
We watched a rerun of that last night. We've got Netflix and we're having a look at it. And one thing we notice is they're having dinner, and then after the dinner, they just go back to their room and they just do like a hobby. Like no one is on a screen or anything. And that's so sort of really surreal when you look at it, because it's like they've got so much time, afterwards.
I get you. Like, and the thing is,
because like you go watch
no one gets involved in community projects anymore.
Mm.
How many people do you know that are volunteers?
Not many, but they're involved in like groups, like specific niche groups.
But we don't wash our cars anymore. We pay someone to do that. We don't mow our lawns. We pay someone to do that. We pay someone to clean our windows. We pay someone to do our dry cleaning. We pay someone to iron our shirts. Not in all cases, but a lot of people do. We pay people to do everything.
Mm.
Everything. Garden maintenance, you name it. Yeah, we've got no time.
Yeah.
We've got no time to do community work or volunteer work or be on a committee at the local football club or be in a committee at the cricket club. Got no time. But, you know, well, hang on a moment. In my day, I had to come back at 4 o'clock to the office and be given 30 messages on a little piece of paper. And I sit there on the landline and I'd ring back every customer. And when I was finished, I'd put a line through the bit of paper and I'd put it on a spike. Today, that's all done on my Bluetooth in the car before I get back to the office. And I can send out everything via emails and with social media can get to a forum and a network that I never once thought was humanly possible.
Yeah. Well, that's probably, you know.
But I've got no time.
But that's probably the reason why, because you can contact so many. So you're spamming 100 people nowadays instead of 30.
So are we just cramming more nowadays than what we ever did maybe before?
I think so, yeah. And that's why so many people struggle with things like context switching, because they're constantly changing the context of what they're doing.
Yep.
Why did you start Dimitina Coffee?
Oh, look, out of necessity. And out of not really having many options, I suppose. I mean, I don't have a lot of formal education. And I've had quite a few jobs and I've been involved in sales most of my life and I've had my own business. I joined Mokopan in 1982, 83. Joe DiMartino was still there at that point in time. He passed away not long after. And his cousin Dom took over as managing director. I started there, humble beginnings. I was delivery driver and so forth, and then moved up to sales representative, then business development manager, then sales manager, and loved the whole pathway. And Dom DiMartino retired. Fred Vaines took over as general manager, managing director. And then in 1995, my relatives who owned the company, the board of directors were aging. They were getting to retirement age and getting older, and there was a sense of the industry starting to change. You just could see that there were new entities coming into the market. There was new branding strategies. Export coffee was still really big at that time. Lavazza was making a big play into the Australian market. And believe it or not, were quite innovative at that time, very innovative. And from a technical point of view, with equipment and machinery, it was just the beginning. It was the dawn of a new age. And they felt that they were smart enough to see that their business, that had been such a successful business over 40 years, would need a huge input of CapEx to take on the next stage of its history. So they decided to sell the company, and they sold the company to a multinational called Cerebos, who owned some fabulous range of products like Saxo Salt, fountain sources, I think Suntory, the beer, they were involved with the Suntory. And
they're famous for like a chicken stock cube.
Chicken stock and all that sort of stuff. So they bought Mokopan, and to their credit, the first couple of years they were fabulous. They were really good. They let us continue to run the business the way we'd been running it. We had a few challenges, but they had a strategic view and they changed the way that we started to run the business. They wanted to go more multinational. They wanted to go retail. And they started to put us on the supermarket shelf. And they moved factories and they sort of chartered playing around with the blends and so forth and just changed the which is their prerogative, it's their business. They just started making a lot of changes and then we became quite institutionalised. We started supplying McDonald's and a lot of institutional accounts. Now, once that happens, you're very vulnerable losing all your base business, which for us was quality cafes, espresso bars and restaurants. At that point in time, Mokopan and Coffex had, I believe, over 70% of the Victorian market sewn up.
And but is this because of the, you know, what's the image now of what happens to that brand? Is it because they start seeing it on shelves and they think, oh, that's not a quality brand? Is that why they would, that base business?
Absolutely. If you own a really cool espresso bar in Flinders Lane, buying 25, 30 kilo a week, make a great coffee, Mokopan's your supplier, and you're the owner, and you get in your car and drive home, and you see a Mokopan neon sign out the front of a service station or out the front of a institutional account like McDonald's, you don't want to be associated with the same brand.
Yeah.
You want to point a difference, and that's understandable. And we knew even in those days, look, in those days you could wear a lot of different hats. So don't get me wrong, coffee companies could supply a Novotel hotel and supply a really cool restaurant and supply a cafe and supply whatever and get away with it, not like today. Today the industry is very segmented. But at that point in time, it was just changing and it was causing a lot of issues for us. We started losing a lot of quality accounts because of that period. Also at that time, when Mokopan sold, Genovese had really started to make a real play in the market. Great family, terrific family, wonderful people, and got a great coffee. But they went from Genrix to Genovese and relaunched their brand and they were sort of perceived as a real cool in vogue brand. And of course, Giancarlo Gusti was really emerging with Grinders Coffee. Grinders went from a small little roastery in Lygon Street, all of a sudden became a major big player in the market. And one of the reasons was that was because Mokopan sold and Coffex sold. So the two big players in the market that had a huge percentage of the market share, they sold. They sold to multinationals. Yeah. Now, when multinationals buy a company, they put their little tweak on it and start to strategically change things, which is fine. That's what happens. But it opened this door for Genovese and Grinders as well. And they made hay while the sun shines. And they picked up a lot of wonderful accounts. They picked up a lot of Coffex and Mokopan accounts in the process. So there were a lot of changes. And to Mokopan's credit, they've really got their stuff together now. They're one of the best institutional coffee companies out there. They supply, you know, they roast enormous amounts of coffee. They've got big institutional accounts, and they've brought back the original Mokopan font that Joe DiMartino had in the 60s. And I've met a lot of the people along the way, at trade shows and stuff, and they're very, very proud of the past and the association and that sort of thing. But it was just time because they were slowly managing all the old staff out of the business. And you could see it happening. Every week another one was going, another one was going,
You saw the writing on the
wall. And I knew that my time would eventually come. And it broke my heart because I'd already been there for 14 years. And even though I had no equity in the company, I still treated the company as if it was my own. It was a family company. I loved the heritage. I loved the history. There wouldn't be a day I didn't go to work and think of my dad and my uncles. And there was a lot of their colleagues were still, you know, working in the industry. But it was inevitable. And I think the turning point was, and I don't tell this to many people, but I remember I was home one day, one morning, and I got up and I was thinking, what will I do? What will I do? And I got up one morning and I walked out into the driveway, and the reject shop, we lived near Chatswood Shopping Centre, and the reject shop have these beautiful big colour brochures they were putting in all the letterboxes with all the products on that they had for sale. And I was going to work and I got the reject shop brochure out and I opened it and there was Mokopan's two leading blends on sale at the reject shop. And I thought, I've just spent the last 12 years of my life putting this product into the best espresso bars and cafes and restaurants in Melbourne, and someone, without even letting me know, and I was a sales manager, that we were selling in the reject shop. I went and tendered my resignation that day. But look, I had a wonderful time there. I had a wonderful time, and I was going to open a coffee lounge or a restaurant. I thought, oh, look, I'll get out. I'll follow my dad's footsteps. I'll do a cafe restaurant. I had 3 months off. Went away on a holiday with the family. And then I thought, you know what? No, I'm not going to do what Dad did. I love coffee. I love coffee. And I had a good think about it. And then in December 1998, I started Dimitona Coffee.
And what were those early years like? Because, I mean, I spoke to one of your boys and they were saying that you're essentially selling coffee out of the back of your car.
Yeah, I was. My cousin Simon Dimitona, my business partner and great friend and cousin, he lives in Western Australia and looks after Dimitona operations there, roasting plant. He couldn't join for quite a while because he was bound by contracts and so forth. So in those early days, you know, I started off and I got a little hire car, $25 a day rent a bomb. went to the news agents, bought a little manual invoice book, and actually went and bought some green bean and had it packed. Paul Bueldo helped me out a lot. He was a wonderful guy, great friend of Jody Martinez. And
where were you getting the beans from?
Paul Bueldo was sourcing them for me at that point in time. Yeah. And I said to Paul, look, this is the blend profile I want. I'd like this, 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 and this. And he sourced it for me and packed it for me. And I loaded up the boot of my car and would drive off in a little renter bomb and go around and see customers and started selling out of the boot of my car.
Yeah.
And I had to, mate, because I had a mortgage and wife, 3 kids, and I needed to put food on the tables.
Yeah.
It's funny what you do out of necessity.
It is. And now you've got your business with how many staff are there?
Look, Australia-wide, we employ about 98.
98,
shit. About 98 people, I think, but the company, I mean, in due course, in due course, when they were able to, a great mate of mine, Lino Bettiol, who I worked at Mokopan with for a long, long time, he was one of those who got managed out as well, and he's had a life involved in production and roasting and dispatch, and he joined me when he could, and then, of course, his wife, Morella, joined. She was wonderful, and she was an absolute workhorse and running admin and helping with, in those days, dispatch and packaging and everything else. And, you know, we started off very, very simple. Then in due course, when Simon could join, he joined. And then in due course, when my cousin Robert could join, he joined. And so we never planned this, but it's amazing how it ended up at Mokopan in the early days. There was Joe Dimitona, Anthony Dimitona, and Dominic Dimitona, and one of their oldest, most loyal and lovely employees was Teresa Bettiol, Signora Bettiol, who was like a big grandma to us all, big nunna in the factory when we were kids growing up. And it's just by irony, the way it worked out, ended up Lino, well, he's the son of Signora Bettiol, he's working at Dimitona, then Simon, son of Joe, then Robert, son of Dominic, and myself, son of Anthony. So it was like, you know, the next generation all went and did exactly the same thing, but it was never planned like that. It's just the jigsaw puzzle just fitted like that, and that was just wonderful. But we all, you know, it was very early days. We started out very primitive, and we got the first roaster we bought in. Paul Bueldo helped us out for about 3 or 4 months, helped me out, about maybe 6 months. Fabulous he was. And then we bought in a 30-kilo Probat roaster, second-hand roaster from Germany.
Yeah.
And we commissioned that, and we got to work, started roasting our own blends and origins, and that was it.
How would you, if you were to explain it to a newbie, how would you describe the industry now?
Describe it now?
Yeah.
Oh, look, it's a dog's breakfast at the moment. It's a dog's breakfast. The industry in terms of the standard has never been better. Never been better. In terms of standard, knowledge, qualifications, resources, equipment, presentation, industry, we are a world leader. It has never been better. In terms of roasting and wholesaling coffee at the moment, it would be very difficult because the industry is overserviced. So, but that's not just coffee. In Australia, we're overserviced in a lot of industries. And it's really interesting in this country because I think a lot of it stems from multiculturalism. But Australians have this absolute obsession with working for themselves. So the percentage of small businesses in Australia in ratio to our population is out of whack, totally out of whack. So I think there's over 1,100 roasters in Australia now.
Wow.
When I started out in 1982, I think there was about 12 or 13 in Victoria. I couldn't tell you what there was nationally, but there couldn't have been more than 50 or 60.
Yeah.
There's well over 1,000 now, over 1,000 roasters. So margins have shrunk, and the cost of sales to obtain a customer and to maintain a customer have never been higher, and our margins have probably never been lower. So it's interesting times. And if I had to do it all over again now, I'm not quite sure whether I would go down that track.
Yeah. We're in, though, what we call the third wave now, aren't
yep.
we?
Yep.
Do you think that has largely affected this?
I think it's a natural transition between positions that you hold within the industry. So when I was in my 20s, there was no such thing as a career barista. They didn't exist. A barista was a mum maybe looking for some part-time work while the kids were at school. It was uni students getting some part-time work, someone doing a second job, or you had a few of the flamboyant full-time baristas in Carlton or North Melbourne that were not long in Australia, had migrated, who made a living out of doing that and playing cards. Now, that was pretty much who made the coffees, or the owner-operator of a cafe restaurant. So what we have seen with a natural progression of knowledge and training is all of a sudden we had people choosing to be a barista as a career.
Right.
Okay, so that's fine. So it encompasses a lot more than what previous baristas were. In actual fact, the word barista didn't exist in the 80s. It was a coffee maker. What do you do? I'm a coffee maker. You know, so a barista was someone that we heard about that came from Italy that had this wonderful knowledge of origins of coffee, and they could adjust grinders and change blades and, you know, program machines and all that sort of thing. So we had this generation of Australians embracing that barista. Yeah. And obviously with that comes a new standard throughout the industry. And it did. The standard is marvellous. It's wonderful. But it's like anything, they don't want to be a barista forever. So after being 5 or 7 years of being a barista, what's the next step?
I don't know, roasting beans.
Own a cafe.
Ah, okay.
What's the next step after that?
Roasting beans.
Exactly. So it's just, and that is why we've seen, as well as the cafe industry being one of the fastest growing industries in Australia, Australia's pro rata drink, oh, look, our coffee consumption's huge.
It's ridiculous now, yeah.
It's really huge. I've forgotten what the latest figures were, but it's amazing. I think we're the second highest consumer of espresso coffee in the world.
Really?
Italy is number one for espresso coffee. Australia is number two.
Wow.
That's an amazing figure. So the explosion, you know, there's espresso bars, espresso machines everywhere, hairdressing salons, clothing boutiques. Every hole in the wall has got an espresso machine in it. It's incredible. So we have an obsession now with espresso coffee. And that stems for a lot of reasons. So the standard's really improved, but what we're seeing now is everybody just taking that natural progressive step in the industry. So, but what it's done, it's created probably a situation where the industry is over-serviced now. But it's interesting because it's all going – everyone wants to buy – there's all these little micro-roasters everywhere and a lot of cafes roasting for themselves as well. So
where do you – if you were to look at the industry then, which encompasses roasters, baristas and coffee shop owners, where do you see the value now? Where do you think – who are the people who make the most money or have the greatest opportunity? Is it someone who can set up a cafe, roast their own beans – and supply that way, or is it you're a person who goes inside the roaster?
It's a really good question. I think there's no doubt the retail roaster. We call them the retail roaster. So you have retail roasters, and you have what commercial wholesale roasters. So Dimatina is a medium-sized family-owned commercial wholesale roaster.
Okay,
we're not retail roasters. We've got a couple of retail outlets in Clarendon Street and in Perth and in Kerr Street, Fitzroy, with some small shop roasters, but we're not specific retail roasters. So,
you're not sold mainly.
Well,
in
we're not. We don't have 10 or 12 outlets roasting for ourselves.
Yeah,
and then we're wholesaling half a ton as well.
Yeah.
Now Australia's full of them now.
Okay.
You know, got a lot of people doing that. That's not what we are. But a lot of those people that have chosen that as their business path have done so well. They really have. They've done extremely well. And I think timing's everything. Timing is everything, and marketing and perception. You know, you look at the innovative. I remember when Lavazza first came to Melbourne in the 1980s, they had a couple of cracks and they couldn't get it over the line. Then I think it was the 90s, early 90s, they were the first coffee company to bring out market umbrellas. I know that sounds corny now, but market umbrellas didn't exist.
Yeah.
Wind barriers didn't exist. And now we don't even put wind barriers and market umbrellas virtually out anymore because they're not. You know, it's not the in vogue thing anymore. But that was really innovative at the time.
Yeah.
And they had these huge, magnificent colour prints of Carla Bruni with her breast hanging out while she's sipping on an espresso, and they're putting them up in shops. And so at that point in time, they were really innovative. They perceived as the cool in vogue coffee company. And at the time, they just rolled it out. And someone from within their organisation thought it would be really clever to put a neon sign in every Shell service station in Australia saying Lavazza, and
they ruined it.
that helped us a little bit. So marketing people, they make me laugh sometimes. But you look at St. Ali, what a great story that is.
I know, yeah.
What He's a wonderful story. So well. If you go back to the late 90s, the early 2000s, there's someone who's just taken the bull by the horn and run with it, and to their credit, you know, incredibly innovative and probably paved the way and opened the door for, you know, another 50, 60 roasters to take a similar sort of path.
So yeah. Where do you think the industry is heading now?
People ask me this question all the time. they really do. I think, like most industries, everything does the full circle.
Okay.
So we have really climbed the mountain in coffee. We have really climbed the mountain to the point now we're reinventing the wheel. So we're doing things a little bit better. We're putting a tweak on it. We're making it slightly different. We might be using a slightly different origin, but in a basic way, we're reinventing the wheel in a lot of ways. So everybody's trying to get the edge. Everybody wants to be perceived as doing something innovative, different, doing it in a more scientific way. Yeah, I think to a certain degree, you can only push that scientific part of it so far. I think that the average punter, the average consumer now, is a little bit at the point that they're just a bit over the whole science of it. That's just my opinion. I speak to so many cafe owners, and you go in there, some of these fit outs are just magnificent, and they look like a science laboratory. You've got every apparatus you can think of making coffee, and people behind the counters whose knowledge is just wonderful. Yet 90% of the customers, flat white please.
Yeah.
Latte please. Flat white please. Latte please. You know, soy milk, piccolo. So that, I'm not being negative. I think it's wonderful where the industry has gone, but I think we have climbed the mountain with research and science, you know, on how coffee's grown and how it's cultivated and where it's from and what the flavour profiles are, and everybody's a cupping expert now, and everybody gets on social media and says it should be done this way or done that way, and the way we've made coffee for the last 50 years is wrong all of a sudden, it should be done like this, and now the way our brew ratios, the way we make coffee and extract it, and the way we weigh all our handles, which is fabulous. We have never been better. Never been better. So it's not a criticism. It's a great observation. But I think it just might level out for a little while. I think it gets to a point where coffee's been the thing for the last 20 years. You can do something almost till it's done to death. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And then it's like, well, you know, you can only stretch it and pull it and shape it in so many ways, shapes and form.
So we could be heading to an era of simplicity.
I think that with a lot of things, to be honest, Jordan. I think in the world today, I do. I think sometimes as human beings, I'm speaking probably on behalf of myself, so I'm not trying to say this is the general view, but I think I've just noticed even in restaurants, talking to a lot of fabulous chefs, they're going back to simplicity. You know, it's amazing how many people come into me all the time and go, oh, I went to this great Italian restaurant. It was unbelievable. Oh, really? What did you have? Oh, I had this wonderful rigatoni with a bit of olive oil and some broccoli on it and a bit of chilli. I've gone, Well, my nunna was cooking that in 1972. You know, my dad was making that back in the 80s. It's not new. Oh, I've got this fabulous filter coffee. It's unbelievable. I know. Wonderful. What is it?
I think
I've got this Kenyan Double A. Yeah, not a problem. I was selling it in 1983 in filter machines. Now, okay, the machine's better today. And the way we're doing it and the way we're temperature wise, the way we're perfecting the way we get the coffee to filter through and so forth is much better. But the basic principle's the same. It's the same.
Mm.
It's like saying I've found this new way of cooking an eye fillet steak. We're still eating them back in the 80s and 90s. We're just cooking a little bit differently now.
Yeah. I think you're definitely right, because you can see it with the type of restaurant. There's now the new thing now in restaurants is, wood fire.
Yep.
Restaurants.
Wood-fired pizzerias are absolutely the flavour of the month, aren't they? They're just amazing, and it's incredible.
There's wood-fired places like, I don't know if you've heard of Embla in the city, where they just they don't have an oven or anything like that. It's just literally wood.
And it's amazing how many places you go to now, and the menu is so limited.
Yeah.
It's so limited.
Yeah, that's another thing. Yeah.
So I just think choices and, I know some of the great cafes we supply are starting to limit their choice of milks, and they're starting to limit their choice of coffee drinks.
Yeah,
because they're all just getting too complex.
What do you think in terms of the industry? If someone was getting into it now, what would be your suggestions?
I think the main thing would be is to do your research. And obviously, networks are huge. If you're someone who's been in the industry for a long time and you know a lot of people and you have a lot of good contacts who are going to support you, well, you're off to a good start, aren't you? But if you're really starting from scratch, you need to really ask yourself this question is okay, let's reverse the situation. I don't know you. I've got an espresso bar or a cafe. You come in to introduce yourself to me. Why would I buy your product? And you've got to find good reasons for why. Now, the industry today has changed. It's not like it was when I was a young lad. You walked around and said, hello, how are you? My name's Paul. I'm from Mokopan Coffee. I've got these fabulous coffees. Would you like to try them? There's not much of that anymore. It's all networking. It's how you're perceived. It's about getting out, walk the walk, talk the talk. You just got to mix and mingle and
do you think understanding like marketing and social media will be core to that as well?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, look, there's no doubt. Absolutely. I mean, trade shows have even become a thing of the past now, really. Yeah, I mean, Mice is terrific, but Mice is more of a retail roaster show. It's a lot of retail roasters are on show there, and it's more about the general public going to get a real good understanding and education of coffee. I don't find a lot of trade people are going to look at whose coffee they're going to use in their cafe.
Yeah.
back in the 80s and 90s, you'd go to a trade show and you'd come out with 100 leads.
Really?
And you'd pick up 30 accounts.
Wow.
So that doesn't happen anymore. So people generally know whose coffee they're going to use before they even get a lease on the premises. So because they've already got a connection, they've already been going to a cafe where they've got a connection with a barista, or they already know someone within the coffee industry, or they might know someone that works at a coffee company, or they've had a coffee at a particular venue and they really like the packaging, or they like the style, or they like the profile. But what's happening now is this is really interesting too. Is when the industry, particularly in Melbourne, when the industry was branded, whether it be Veneziano, Dimatina, Genovese, Toby's Estate, whatever it might be, Supreme, All Press, when it was branded and cafes were branded and you walk in and you could see the brand whose coffee it was, if that venue was doing particularly well with that particular brand, very hard for them to change. Because all the customers come in, can see whose brand they got and they form an identity with it. Melbourne's changed. The top 200 cafes in Melbourne now probably haven't even got any branding. Or everyone's got their own bag now with their own name on it and their own brand. So all of a sudden, you don't know whose coffee you're drinking. So Melbourne coffee drinkers who love the industry now, for the first time ever, are probably not having an affinity or an identity with a coffee brand, but with the venue.
Right.
But it used to be, I go there because they've got All Press. I go there because they've got Dimatino. I don't go there because they've got Dimatino. I don't go there because they've got such and such.
So now it's about the actual venue.
Well, it is, because, and I'm so glad, because when the industry was very heavily branded, I mean, if someone was making a bad coffee or a bad product with your brand, it was an indictment on you. It hurt you.
Right.
It hurt you. So Melbourne's really gone away from branding, but back in the 90s, even the early 2000s, it was very heavily branded.
Yeah.
You know, it was very heavily branded. Today, most places, particularly Melburnians, love exclusivity. And a lot of coffee companies, and it's really interesting now, a lot of big commercial wholesale roasters are coming up with all these new funky brand names in some really funky packaging, supplying some of the coolest cafes in Melbourne. And if only the customers knew that it was a big commercial wholesale roaster, but they don't. They think it's some little backyard micro roaster, but it's not.
Knowing what you know now, what would you do differently?
I probably wouldn't have grown the business as quickly as I did.
Right.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. With growth comes cost of sales.
Yeah.
And you've got to be able to manage that. The first 3 years, I grew at a rate that was ridiculous. I was work, and exhausted all my networks, and obviously really wanted to prove a point that I could make this work and it would succeed. So, but I probably would have had more cost-effective structured growth. You've got to have budgeted, cost-effective, structured growth.
Yeah.
You can put yourself under a lot of financial pressure, you know, by growing the business. It's amazing how some people have got an enormous customer base and they really grow the business quickly, but they can't fund the growth. So I probably did a little bit of that, put too much pressure on myself and my partners doing that.
Yeah. So you think you scaled too quickly?
Yeah, I think so. I probably should have been a bit more proactive in researching better equipment too in the early days.
Right.
I think the third wave has really got to jump on some of the more established commercial wholesale roasters with innovative equipment. There's no doubt with innovative equipment, and probably should have spent more time and research on training and development from within. They're things I've really learned from the third waivers. They've been terrific. They've really put a lot of focus on great training and development with their staff. They do a lot of research. They source out the best equipment, and they, you know, it's amazing. When I, my early days, I'd walk into a cafe. I knew 10 times more about coffee than any cafe owner did. Today, I can walk into a cafe and I can have a staff member of that cafe knows more about the coffee industry than I do after 38 years.
Wow,
that's how much. Emphasis is placed on training and development and research. And I think back in the early 2000s when all the little micro roasters were starting to emerge, I went to Seattle in 2005 and I came back and said to my board, I said, look, I think the biggest threat in Australia to commercial roasters is going to be micro roasters. They're coming. And I don't think we took it seriously enough. I think we thought, oh, yeah, it won't work. People won't roast their own coffee. They won't know how to do it properly and all this sort of thing. You couldn't have got anything further from the truth.
Yeah.
You know, now Australia has just this wonderful array of, you know, hundreds and hundreds of quality roasters, great coffee.
Now I want to jump into some quicker questions because I know you've got to be in a meeting soon. maybe we'll start with say something on a billboard, and this billboard could be anywhere in Australia,
mm-hmm.
What would it say and where would it be?
Yeah, that's a good question. Anywhere in Australia?
Yeah.
Surely
down on Punt Road.
Melbourne. Definitely Melbourne. And one word. One word? Resilience.
Okay. I like that.
Resilience, yeah. When you get knocked off your bike, get back on and keep riding.
Do you have any best purchases under $200 that you've made over the last few years?
Best purchases under $200? Some sexy lingerie. not for me.
What do you do for your exercise routine?
Eat, drink, Very embarrassing because the last 3 years, I've been a fitness fanatic all my life. But the last 3 years have been the worst I've ever been in terms of fitness. But generally, it used to be running, but my knees are gone. So now it's walking. Obviously, try and get to the gym, have a workout. And walking. I get down the footy club a bit and do, you know, try and have a kick of the footy with the boys every now and then. But I don't ride a bike much. I used to do a bit of bike riding, but not much. No, just pretty much walking. I still try and go for a run every now and then. And gym work. Yep.
What do you think you're most proud of?
Oh, look, I think the most thing I'm proud of obviously is, you know, look, I'm a father of three, so I think anyone that's had children who grow up to be A, healthy, B, happy, and C, good citizens. You've got to say you've got to be proud of that. I mean, that's more you can ask for as a parent. In terms of business, to be able to say that I've stood the test of time, to think that out of the back of a rent-a-bomb car with the wonderful support of my partners and relatives and cousins, we were able to build a respected family brand that has stood the test of time. That's evolving. It's relaunching with a whole new fantastic array of packaging and branding at the moment. I think it looks really cool. We supply some of Melbourne's best espresso bars and cafes and restaurants throughout Australia. We're a national company. We're in Adelaide, Gold Coast, Brisbane, Byron Bay, Hervey Bay, Cairns. We've set up a marketing office in Shanghai. We've got a distribution network in Hong Kong, Singapore, Malaysia. So we're roasting in Bali. So to think from humble beginnings, we're able to employ nearly 100 people full-time who are like one big extended family. We don't get a lot of, you know, another thing which I think is a testament to Dimatina Coffee, our staff retention is really high, as is our customer retention. So I'm really proud of that. I'm just proud of that. I go to work every day and have fun, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm really proud of that.
What's an obsession that you find yourself exploring in your spare time?
An obsession I have to...
That you explore in your spare time.
An obsession that I explore in my spare time is walking the dog. I find walking my whippet Oscar, he's my best mate. I'm obsessed with it. Without my morning walk with Oscar, I don't get off to a good start.
Really?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm obsessed with going for – I love driving along Beaconsfield Parade, looking out at the bay. Absolutely love that. I'm obsessed with doing that. I like to do that two or three times a week. Obsessed with having my morning coffee. If I don't get my morning espresso before about 9:30, get irritable.
Yeah.
I get a bit irritable. I'm obsessed with taking time out for 30 minutes every morning.
Okay.
And reading the paper. Love it. Think anyone should do it. Yeah, I just little things that I do that it's my time.
Yeah.
And they're my little obsessions. Yeah.
Last question for you. What insight seems obvious about life to you but not to others?
I think, it's a little bit subjective. I mean, I can't totally know what other people are thinking, but... I don't take life for granted. Life's not a competition for me, and it's about waking up and smelling the roses. As much as I've had a lot of fun in life and a lot of success, I've also had a lot of sadness around me as well. I've lost a lot of family people close to me when I was very young in life. By the time I was 18, I'd lost three uncles, father, grandparents, cousin. Even now, you know, I've lost a lot of people close to me in their 40s and 50s and so forth. So it's not about – life's not about material wealth for me. It never really has been. Don't get me wrong. I want to live comfortably and have a nice life. But it's not about striving for some ridiculous material wealth or something. It's really not. I don't take life for granted. I do wake up and smell the roses. And I think that's something that a lot of other people – perhaps don't do. I think some people just think they're bulletproof, can go forever. It's all about, they don't care who they step on or who they push or what in the back to get to the top to do that. But that's not for me. Life's about really good business principles. It's about being transparent. It's about being honourable. It's about being able to leave this workforce one day and say, well, look, over the last 40, 45 years, the journey has had far many more ups than it has downs. I've made some wonderful friends, lifetime friends. I've never burnt anyone. I've always been fairly honest, or not fairly, I've always been very honest in my business dealings. And, you know, I've enjoyed myself and had a lot of fun along the way. You're only here for a short time. You want to be able to laugh, you want to be able to smile, we don't have to sleep at night. They're the basic principles that are really important to me. You know, maybe that might be simplistic Italian stuff, but family, good food, good health, a lot of laughing, the Tigers winning. They're the things that are important to me.
It's a good motto to have.
Yeah.
Look, Paul, thank you so much for doing this. We will link, of course, everything, the website to Dimitina Coffee. You guys are obviously across all of social media. Peering through your Instagram profiles, and whatnot. You've obviously got someone managing that.
We have, yes. Yes, it's not me, obviously. No, actually, my son, Christopher, does
a bit of
it. Yeah, we've got a national marketing manager, Tony Riccelli. She's based in Perth.
Okay.
And she's fantastic. And then my son, Chris, is the he does a lot of the coordination for the eastern states.
Okay.
And and Candy, another one of our employees, does a fair bit of that. So that's all good. Very good.
Well, look, like I said, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Jordan. Lovely to talk about coffee and all things in life.
Cheers. Thank you for making it this far. We hope you enjoyed the episode. If you like the episode, maybe consider leaving us a review. Just head to the web, search iTunes or Stitcher. When you get to that, go Uncommon Neural and it'll be the first podcast available. Maybe as well consider signing up to the newsletter. I think about 90%, I last checked, of our subscribed listeners are on the newsletter as well. From there, you'll get show notes, priority access. You'll be the first to know when an episode is live. Head to neural.com/podcast and fill in your details there. Don't forget to like us on Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, or Instagram. So until next time, thanks for listening.